Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks once again for joining us as we continue to plow through the big monster box of baseball cards, primarily from the 80s, but we've got quite a few cards from the 90s, and we continue moving through the 1990 releases. This time around, we're looking at Fleer, one of my favorite sets, not only from that company, but in the 1990 baseball season. And our random pull, one of my favorite pitchers and currently broadcasters, John Smoltz of the Atlanta Braves, infamously traded from the Detroit Tigers organization to Atlanta during the Tigers' 87 playoff run. Card number 595, we'll talk about that in just a little bit, as well as the 1990 Fleer set as a whole. And I hope that you had a very happy, safe, and dare I say productive Thanksgiving holiday yesterday. I say productive in the sense that maybe you were able to move off the couch for a little bit. Maybe you helped somebody in the family clean up some dishes, something like that. You weren't a total slug. But again, I hope that you had a very good Thanksgiving weekend. And it's now the crazy time as we all get ready for Christmas and New Year's and all the fun things that come around there. So while you stuff yourself on food and overspending over the next few weeks, I hope that you keep stuffing yourself with the Wax Ecstatic podcast, which comes your way on Tuesdays and Fridays via Audio Boom. And of course, iTunes. Make sure you tell your friends about Wax Ecstatic. As again, we'll continue to go through the 1990 sets. We've got a couple more of those. And then it's on to 1991, and the Monster Box pretty much dies out in 1993. So we got a few more years, quite a few more sets to go through, and we're having a lot of fun doing it at the same time. We also always have a lot of fun taking a look at your comments on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Tell your friends about that as well, as we always have a very interesting conversation, not only about our podcast, but about the cards that we talk about, some of the players that we talk about as well, including some not-so-good trades for fans' favorite teams. This was a big part of our Twitter feed read through, if you will, in our last podcast on the 1990 Score podcast. And of course, it stems from the 1990 Bowman podcast, the Paul O'Neill to the New York Yankees trade. I said, is that the worst trade in Cincinnati Reds history? Because you could argue it's, if not equal to the Frank Robinson trade to Baltimore, it's right up there. It may be the worst trade in franchise history. So we had a whole bunch of trade suggestions in our last podcast. Got a couple more that came in late. Let's see, Box of Cubs. Can you guess? A Cubs fan? Without a doubt, the Lou Brock trade to St. Louis. Yeah, that is, you know, the Cubs have had some doozies over the years, but that is still, more than 50 years later, still the worst trade in Cubs history. Although, as we mentioned in the last podcast, they made out like bandits in the Larry Boa and Ryan Sandberg trade for Evan DeJesus. So, yeah, it balances out over time. But for many, many years, as the Cubs continue to suffer through losing season after losing season, you're watching Lou Brock just burn up the base paths in St. Louis. And up until Ricky Henderson topped him, was the all-time stolen base leader in Major League Baseball. So Cubs fans, again, kicking themselves over that deal. And even though the Cubs finally won a World Series, you're still kicking yourself over that deal from over 50 years ago. One more, Jim Sousa says, Joe Nathan for A.J. Pierzynski. Yeah, that's a little tilted. I agree with you, and especially since A.J. Pierzynski is pretty much a loudmouth. You know, he's just one of those really annoying guys who typically says something just to say something, and you'd rather he not say anything. So yeah, I will go with you on that one there. That's a pretty lousy deal there, Joe Nathan for A.J. Pierzynski. Now, let's talk a little bit about the 1990 Score podcast. We've got a couple of comments from our friends Baseball Card Backs. I referred to the 1990 Score set, a very colorful set, as the Hammer Pants set or the In Living Color set. It is very 1990. You look at it and you go, yep, that's from 1990. And Baseball Card Backs actually finds a Hammer Pants card. Okay, well, not a Hammer Pants card, but an MC Hammer card. Pro Set sent out a set of cards in 1991 called Superstars Music Cards. Now, if you are too young to remember this time in the hobby, I'm talking about 1990, 91, 92, this is evidence that anybody could have a trading card. And we're not just talking about the Bizarro baseball cards. I actually have, from I think it's 1993, a card that came in a box of dog food. And it was trading cards, baseball players with their dogs. So I have a Will Clark and his dog card. I forget, you know, who the maker of the dog food is, but you had those types of cards. You also had, I remember, you had these fake baseball players in Slim Jim cards. Yeah. So everybody was just crapping out cards left and right in 1990 and 91 and 92. And Pro Set, no exception here. As we're very thankful, Baseball Card Back sent us a picture of the MC Hammer card here. As what's really entertaining here, other than the fact that this looks very much like anything from 1991, you know, if 90 Score looked like MC Hammer, 1991 Pro Set, the MC Hammer card, certainly had that special vibe to it. And the funny thing here is on the back of this biography, it says, "Don't expect MC Hammer to just keep rapping. His future plans include a movie career." Well, thank God for that. So things haven't worked out so well for Hammer, but he is too legit to quit. So perhaps that movie career is still hanging out there. Also, Baseball Card Backs points out the Eric Lindros card that I mentioned is actually from the traded set for Score. So my bad on that. It is card number 100T. I remember seeing pictures of it going, oh, yeah, I remember that insert. It is a traded card, so I stand corrected there. But as for the Eric Lindros card, because you only look at the back of the card, Baseball Card Backs, talking about multi-sport stars. And it says, Eric is another in a growing list of multi-talented athletes who are cropping up in the sports world with increasing frequency. Unlike Bo, Dion, and DJ, however, his two sports are hockey and baseball. So we have Bo Jackson, we have Dion Sanders, and DJ Dozier. One of these three is not like the other. you have two guesses. What's interesting, though, and this being from a guy who works for a hockey team, is that they do mention on the back of this card Kirk McCaskill, who is best known for his brief time in the major leagues with the California Angels, was actually drafted by the Winnipeg Jets in 1981 and had a brief career in the American Hockey League. So if you didn't know that, not just Tom Glavine, the only hockey and baseball dual sport star. Tom Glavine actually drafted something like 107 picks ahead of Luke Robitaille by the Los Angeles Kings in 1987. Now Eric Lindros as well and Kirk McCaskill. So it's interesting sometimes the dual sport stars. And Lindros, even though he spurned the Quebec Nordiques in the 1991 entry draft and basically set up two Stanley Cup championships for the Colorado Avalanche, nay, Quebec Nordiques, with his demand to get traded to the Philadelphia Flyers, he did indeed star in the NHL and was recently inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. So some fun stuff there from Baseball Card Backs. Now, not from Baseball Card Backs, but a very interesting Baseball Card Back. From our friend Joey W., he's got the back of the 1987 Topps Von Hayes card. And Von Hayes was the subject of our 1983 Donruss podcast from a few months back. Card number 666, well, there you go. I mean, Von Hayes getting the mark of the beast in this particular set here. The interesting player tidbit, Von played Little League ball as a youngster. Well, I certainly hope so. If he was 23 playing Little League ball, we may have to call the authorities. Of course, my response is Von Hayes also got a year older on his birthday. But also Tim Murray brings up, I wonder if he also enjoys listening to music. That, of course, refers to another infamous Topps tidbit on the back of a card. As, you know, the people who wrote those little notes for Topps, I wonder if they're still employed by Topps. I should find that out. But it's interesting. It's not easy coming up with these tidbits because out of a 792 card set every year, you only had maybe 60 or 70 players who had been in the major leagues long enough to where you didn't have room for interesting tidbits and stats on the back. you know, in 1989, yeah, you had Tommy John with his card in 1989, and he had 25 years of professional baseball service. He didn't have any room to put anything on there. But for the roughly 730 other cards, you had to come up with something. So you came up with a stat like, you know, so-and-so hit his first big league home run on this date, or so-and-so pitched his first complete game shutout on this date. But then you have the ones where you know the guys are stretching. And Von Hayes, by 1987, had been in the big leagues for a few years. He, as we mentioned in the 83 Donruss podcast, had a very nondescript career. It wasn't bad. It was just nothing really just greatly stood out in his career. So I can only imagine the fact files at Topps by 1987 were getting pretty thin, and somebody just said, oh, hell, he played Little League as a kid. Let's throw that in there. So I'm sure they were stretching just a little bit, but a very funny card back tidbit there from our friend Joey W. Thank you so much for sharing. And thanks to everybody who shared comments and follows on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And again, please share that with your card collecting friends or even those who don't collect anymore. The ones who, like a lot of us, gave it up back when we were teenagers in the 1990s and maybe kicked it off to the side for a little bit. It's always good to talk about the hobby and especially about some of these cards. And today we're going to be talking about the 1990 Fleer set. This is one of my favorite sets, as we've got random pull John Smoltz. We'll talk about him. Of course, most everybody knows about Smoltzy and his career and, of course, his success as a broadcaster now. But I've got to talk about the 1990 Fleer set first of all, because even though this is one of those overproduced sets, as were pretty much every set in 1990, it's still one that if I get a wax pack and I open it up, I still have a lot of fun opening it up and just seeing what's in there. I've always loved the design of the cards. There's just something special about this set that has stuck with me all these years later. And I think for me, it's a personal connection with my family. In 1990, I was going full speed ahead in the card collecting hobby. I got into it the year before. So in 1989, I'm checking out different brands and starting to amass a collection. Well, by 1990, I am all in. And every spare dime of my allowance, yes, we used to get dimes in our allowance back then, kids, but every dime of my allowance somehow, some way, went to baseball cards back then. That was my life. So I remember pretty much every Sunday after my family went to church, across the street from our church was a grocery store. It was an Albertsons, which used to be pretty predominant here in Florida. Now there's only a handful left. I think they're still big in the Pacific Northwest. I remember going to the store pretty much every Sunday, and while my parents were going around picking up five or six things, I would go off to the side, and I remember the exact location of the baseball card section. It was in between the checkout area and the photo finish area, the photo lab, which of course used to be big things in all sorts of stores. And right there was a little display rack. You had various boxes and racks of cards just hanging everywhere. And 1990 Fleer, not only did I buy packs here, but I would buy the cello packs. So it wasn't just wax packs, it was cello packs. And there were lots of cello packs in this particular Albertsons store. And I think back then it was only like $2 for a cello pack. And you got, I think, 35 cards and a bunch of stickers. I couldn't tell you how many 1990 Fleer stickers were stuck on and may still to this day, 26 years later, are still stuck on something that I own. Because I bought so many Fleer cards in 1990, there's a lot of Fleer stickers on random objects throughout West Central Florida from my childhood. So I always remember the cello packs and the Fleer cello packs. They didn't hide anything. They just, I mean, there were the cards. They were right there. And almost every time that we went into that store, I would buy the cello packs. And then even later on, I would buy the wax packs too. And, you know, another family connection. It's so funny how little things you remember many years later, they just stick in your mind. And I remember visiting my grandparents in Brooklyn, New York, and I would actually stay in the basement. They had a brownstone in Brooklyn, in the Bay Ridge area. And I would stay in the basement. And the basement was actually this well-designed, you know, almost like a party guest area. You know, it wasn't like they just banished me to the basement. But I would stay in the basement. And of course, you're in you know, Brooklyn, and you're visiting your grandparents around Christmas, it gets a little chilly in the basement. So I remember, you know, listening to Z100 on a radio and ripping through a few FLIR packs I'd bought on, you know, bought at some store on Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn, and, you know, just going through these cards and stacking them up and taking them back home. So a lot of fond memories for me from my childhood and just these personal connections with this one particular set, even though this wasn't the only one that I bought in 1990. In fact, I think I bought a hell of a lot more Tops than I did FLIR. There's just this rather unique connection for me to this set. So I may like it a lot more than the quote unquote average hobbyist, certainly more than you, because there are some plain elements to the 1990 FLIR set, but it's always stuck out to me. It's kind of had this all-American appeal to it, and it just works. It just looks really good. And like I said, even nowadays, you know, if you gave me a random stack of wax packs from, you know, the 80s and 90s, if there's a 90 FLIR set in there, or 90 FLIR pack, I should say, in there, I know from a financial standpoint, I'm not going to be paying off loans with any of the cards that are in there. You know, you might be lucky and find, you know, a $1 Sammy Sosa rookie card. But there's just a really fun thing about this particular set, and I'll still go through them. And even though the common cards are extremely common and, you know, again, worth maybe a penny a piece, and the star cards are worth often less than a dollar, it's still a neat set. I still enjoy looking at the cards and going through them. And it's, again, that connection to my childhood. This is very similar to my connection with 89 Tops, that first pack of baseball cards I bought. So 90 FLIR has that same special connection for me, as did my first set. Now, what's interesting about the 90 FLIR set, they have the great card stock, as FLIR always had. And while a lot of the sets from the mid to late 80s were the business style, if you listen to any of the past podcast about the 84 through really 87 sets, or excuse me, 83 through 87 sets, you'll understand what I'm talking about. It was a very clean cut, straightforward, no messing around set. Well, 1990, they had a very clean-cut look to them, but again, kind of this all-American feel. And part of it, much like 89 Tops had that Dodger-style script on the front with the team name and the player name in it that really, really stood out for many years and you know, a lot of fans still identify with, the 90 FLIR set, you've got this kind of wavy banner effect at the bottom of the inside frame. You've got a lot of white space on the border here. A lot of white space. Very unusual for the direction that baseball cards were going in at that time. Because again, Upper Deck coming out in 89, even though they had borders, they were still all about showcasing more photography and less design. Well, FLIR was actually kind of going the other direction. They would definitely do that in 1991, I think, to their detriment. But 1990, you had a lot of white space. You had this inside border with a color coordination that went along with the team color. So in this case of John Smoltz, the Atlanta Braves, you have this dark blue color. And it just has this, I don't want to say patriotic feel, but just has this classic baseball, classic Americana look to it. Which, again, in 1990, you know, the era of the hammer pants, the 1990 score set, 1990 Tops is a very 1990 set. As we'll discuss in our next podcast, the Donruss set was, well, that was an unmitigated disaster. But, you know, while everyone else was, for the most part, going wild and crazy with their design in 1990, FLIR kept it very simple and very classic. There is a neat little throwback feel to this. And when you look at this, you see some of the typical FLIR features. You have their logo up in the upper left-hand corner. You have the team logo in the upper right-hand corner. And as always, love team logos. Anywhere you can work them in, that's a good thing. But also you have that 3D effect, something that they started perfecting with the 1987 FLIR set. In this case, John Smoltz isn't just pictured on the card. He is leaping out of the card here. And again, in the late 80s, early 90s, 3D technology was a little clunky. It didn't quite come off right. FLIR was able to do that with the positioning of their cards. And other car companies would start doing this as well. Topp started picking up on it. And of course, you know, Upper Deck with their high quality photos and graphics, they were able to do that as well. But FLIR was able to continue doing that in 1990. And I think that makes really what's a very average picture of John Smoltz just standing around pregame somewhere. It stands out because he is quite literally standing out of the card with the ball cap that he's wearing, his, you know, basically the top third of his head kind of poking out at the top of the card. I think one of the bad things about 90 FLIR, though, is the photography is typically very dark. The quality took a step back in 1990 for some reason. You see a lot of dark pictures on there. So I think that's probably the only drawback to the set. But despite that, the front of the card is very cool. Like I said, just that Americana, that classic baseball feel to it. And then you flip it over on the back, you not only get that classic baseball feel, you get classic FLIR. You know, basically some of the elements that they had done for many, many, many years cropping up again on the 1990 set, starting off with the player name, personal information at the very top, and this, you know, again, kind of the wavy pennant look here, wavy banner look at the top, the card number up at the top, upper right-hand corner, and just a reminder, FLIR back then was still ordering cards by their teams finished the year before, so in 1989, the Dodgers would have been the first team, and, well, the Braves 595, you kind of know where they finished in 1989. You had the career stats, including minor leagues, for the player from top to bottom, and you have the alternating stripes. You have this almost like a bubblegum look here, kind of the pink-white alternating stripes. And then you have the interesting infographic at the bottom, and this is something, again, FLIR started doing in 1987, a very unique way of sharing stats in the game, ahead of the curve with, you know, advanced stats nowadays, but different from what we saw in Bowman, where you were doing a team-by-team split as to how a player performed against the opposition. Well, in 1990, they had what they called vital signs. So you had some very in-depth statistics for hitters and pitchers. And in the case of John Smoltz, you have the walk ratio per nine innings to a strikeout ratio per nine innings. So that's a very unique way of saying, okay, John Smoltz won't wow you with his fastball. Of course, as he got older, he did. But he's still, on average, almost 2.5 to 1 going to strike you out than walk you. And opposing batter's average. I've always loved the stat. You know, you can look at a pitcher's win-loss record. You can look at his earned run average. You can look at his strikeout-to-walk ratio. But what are hitters hitting against him? I mean, that's a very basic advanced stat there. And even though John Smoltz struggled early on in his Braves career, I mean, you can just look at the first two seasons. I know he had a 2.94 earned run average in 89, but it was tough getting wins. And in 88, he really had a tough start to his Braves career. But the opponents were hitting 212. So if they were hitting him, they were going yard. But more often than not, he was getting the outs. And as you could see through the strikeout and walk ratios, it was often with a swing and a miss. So a very interesting way of breaking down some standard stats, once again, by the FLIR company. And that's something that I loved in the 87 through 90 sets. They really picked apart some interesting stats. And again, well ahead of the curve of course, Sabermetrics was starting out then, but the love for advanced stats that you see nowadays, not just in baseball, but in all sports. So very classic throwback Americana baseball look to the front of the card and the back of the card as well. And again, I think that's one reason why I like the 1990 FLIR set so much. It is just a very good design, very simple, very clean. Now, if you're looking for 1990 FLIR sets and cards, well, you're in luck because they were created in 1990. There's a gazillion of them out there. And that's, again, the downside. If you're looking for any kind of financial payback through collecting 1990 FLIR, don't. Just don't. Just save yourself the trouble. It's not worth it, as there's a lot, and I mean a lot, of this product I've actually seen. You can get a lot of 3 wax boxes. So you're looking at over 100 packs here, not including shipping, $12. I've seen that out there. So you include shipping. Okay, you're probably looking at another $20 for shipping. But, I mean, that's ridiculously cheap. And the Fleer set also comes out at around $20 to $25, which is pretty standard for factory sets from that day. Some good rookies in here. Juan Gonzalez, I would say, is probably the big one. Sammy Sosa, Larry Walker as well. Moises Alou. Also, David Justice, talking about Atlanta Braves, a guy that probably got a little more of the spotlight than he should have back then, but David Justice was one of the hot rookie cards in 1990 and 91 as well. So those stick out there. So I would say this is definitely a series or a set that if you're going to buy it, you're buying it for the exact same reason I'm buying it, and that is you just have this really nostalgic connection to it. And you like the look of the card anyway. But I can tell you, once you rip open the pack and you look through them and go, wow, I remember that, they definitely go into a stack of common cards. They go into the commons box. And then you're wondering, well, what do I do with these? How do I get rid of these? So it's still a favorite of mine, always will be. But it's definitely one where I would not sink too much money into it. You're buying these just for the hell of it, just for a throwback to 26 years ago, however old you were, however many cards you were buying. That's pretty much it. 660 card set, so a very easy set to collect, not only because it's smaller than a lot of the other releases that year, but also because there's a lot of it out there. And it won't cost you that much. But if you're somebody who just likes to put sets together and you just want an easy one to put together, 1990 Fleer is a pretty good option. And at least you'll have some fun doing it because it is a good card to look at. All right, let's take a look at John Smoltz, his career. Again, a lot of people already know about his career. It stands out for a number of reasons. One, though, of course, is the trade from Detroit to Atlanta. And we actually brought this up heading into our 1990 Score podcast when I posted pictures of some famous players who were traded from one team to another. John Smoltz, we actually found a picture of Smoltzy wearing a Detroit Tigers uniform, I believe from spring training, maybe 1986, 87. And a lot of people remember that trade from Detroit to Atlanta because it became such a focal point when the Braves started getting good in 1991, and of course they would be in the postseason and the World Series quite a bit in the 1990s. I mean, you can close your eyes and still hear Tim McCarver telling you exactly every detail about that trade between these two teams. Now, Smoltzy was drafted in the 22nd round of the 1985 amateur draft. That, to me, is almost more amazing than the trade. Here's a guy who turned out to be a Hall of Famer, but clearly he wasn't setting the world on fire when he was in high school, even though he was a dual sport threat. He played football and baseball. But the hometown team decided to give him a shot. He was from Lansing, Michigan, so the Tigers in the 22nd round say, well, why not? So they draft him in 1985. Well, in 1987, the Tigers are in a playoff run. They're in a race to get into the playoffs, taking down the Blue Jays in the final weekend, a very memorable weekend series at Tiger Stadium. The Tigers were able to overtake the Blue Jays and move on to the American League Championship Series, ultimately losing that to the Minnesota Twins in 87. But in order to shore up things, the Tigers needed to get a veteran arm. So they trade for Doyle Alexander. Now, when I say a veteran arm and Doyle Alexander, those are words that most definitely go together because Alexander had been in the big league since 1971. This was a guy who was nearing the end of his career. He was 36 years old at the time of the trade, but this was a guy who could be a spot starter. You can make him your number five guy in the rotation. You could call on him out of the bullpen. Doyle Alexander was not a very special pitcher. He had a few good seasons, especially ironically with Toronto in the early 80s, but he also had some success along the way with the Orioles and the Texas Rangers. But, you know, this wasn't exactly trading for an ace. This was the guy that you were plugging in there with some experience who could kind of help a young team come along here. And of course, the Tigers had won the World Series in 84. So anytime you can bring in one more veteran person, well, why not? Well, you know the old saying, to get something, you got to give something. So the Tigers move John Smoltz for Doyle Alexander straight up. Now, hindsight being 2020, it looks like the worst trade in Detroit Tigers history. And of course, because we know why. The Tigers didn't win the World Series in 1987. In fact, they didn't get there. And in fact, they wouldn't make it to another World Series until 2006. They had some very, very lean years, to put it very nicely, in the 90s and the early 2000s. While John Smoltz, part of a great trio of starting pitchers alongside Tom Glavine and Greg Maddux, won a World Series in Atlanta in 1995, appeared in several World Series, won, 14 consecutive division titles. So, yeah, you'll look back at it now and you go, geez, what an awful trade. But when you look at John Smoltz's minor league stats, and he only made it up to Double A in the Detroit system, he was not doing very well. He had really stumbled out of the gate when starting his pro career. So, really, if you're the Detroit Tigers on August 12th, 1987, you're looking for a veteran guy to help you out in your playoff push, and you've got to give something up, and you're talking to the bottom feeder Atlanta Braves. Well, sure, I'll take this veteran Doyle Alexander off your hands and give you this 22nd round, kind of, sort of, okay, nice kid, but not really good pitcher in John Smoltz. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye. And that was it. Now, Smoltzy was able to turn it around after a rough start in Atlanta in the late 80s. He was able to turn it around, first of all, just with some reps. You know, he was finally able to get some more experience at the professional level. Of course, the team around him helped him out quite a bit. As I mentioned, he had a young Tom Glavine with the team at the time. And I'm talking about 1991 here. They'd yet gone out and brought in Greg Maddux. But you also had, you know, think back to the 91 Braves. You had Lonnie Smith. You had Terry Pendleton. You had the rookie David Justice. You know, you had that very surprising Braves team kind of lifting everybody up. Well, in the middle of the 1991 season, John Smoltz sees a sports psychiatrist, and he sorts things out, and he goes on a terrific run, and that pretty much sums up his pro career from there. From the middle of 1991 straight through the 1990s, up until he had Tommy John surgery in 2000, he was one of the more dominant starting pitchers in Major League history. Now, when I say dominant, I don't mean, again, you know, he didn't blow a 102-mile-an-hour fastball past you. He did have a pretty good four-seam fastball, however. But it wasn't just that one pitch that he counted on. He had quite the arsenal of pitches. A deadly split-finger fastball. He had a hell of a slider. He also had a pretty good curveball, if I remember. And once he got a little older, and he would move to the bullpen, more on that in a moment, but as he got older and you couldn't count on, you know, the speed of a fastball, he got crafty. You know, he was throwing knuckleballs, too. Not very well, but at least he was trying something. So he didn't just have one pitch or just the out pitch. He had a slew of pitches. And even though Greg Maddux would put together more gaudier numbers than John Smoltz did, you could almost say that in terms of artistics, Maddux and Smoltz were very similar. And of course, Glavine is in there as well. I mean, Glavine was known more for throwing heat, but he could mix it up too. So, you know, here's a guy who, despite some injuries along the way and some rocky stretches along the way, he had a phenomenal career in the 1990s, not surprisingly aligning with the Braves' most successful seasons. And his most successful season came in 1996, ironically the year after the Braves won the World Series, and he was good in the 95 season. But in 96, he just blew the competition out of the water. 24-8 record, 2.94 earned run average, 276 strikeouts to 55 walks. That is almost a 6-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio. Not surprising. An all-star year. He won the Cy Young Award that year as well. And he was in the MVP discussion, although he finished a distant 11th in that race. Now, as I mentioned, he did have some arm problems throughout his career, especially in the late 90s. And in 2000, he missed that season with Tommy John surgery, had troubles as a starter after that surgery, and he got moved to the bullpen after the whole John Rocker issue blew up in the Braves' face in 2002. Smoltz moves into the bullpen, and boy, was he ever successful there. In 2002, 55 saves, just a couple behind Bobby Thigpen for the Major League record for saves in a season. As a reliever, he finished third in the Cy Young Award voting. The following seasons, he had 45 and 44 saves. And then with the Braves, you know, cycling through their starting rotation, you know, Greg Maddux went back to Chicago. Tom Glavine starts his career over with the Mets. well, hey, we've got John Smoltz here. His arm hasn't fallen off. Let's put him back in the starting rotation. And that's where he went for the next four seasons with the Braves. Now, a very bitter ending to his time in Atlanta, again, dealing with a lot of injuries. He appeared in only a handful of games in 2008. The Braves deciding not wanting to re-sign a 41-year-old starting pitcher, decide to let him walk. The Boston Red Sox decide to take a flyer on him. Does not work out well there, as he's not only battling injuries, but he was just fighting the mound, going 2-5 with an 8.33 earned run average in how many games did he appear in? Only eight games with the Red Sox. They designate him for assignment. He won't take the minor league assignment, so a deal is worked out with him and the St. Louis Cardinals. The Cards pick him up for a playoff push, ironically, just like the Tigers did in 87 with Doyle Alexander. And even though he had a slightly better stint with the Cardinals at age 42, and yes, he did appear in the Cardinals playoff series against the LA Dodgers in relief, although not a very impressive one in 2009, that would pretty much end his career at the age of 42, but with some very impressive numbers and credentials along the way. Now, what's interesting is when you look in terms of wins and losses and, strikeout to walk ratios in world championships, John Smoltz doesn't differ that much from the random poll from our previous podcast, David Wells. Now, David Wells gave up a lot more home runs and gave up a lot more runs in general. But a lot of people were surprised that Smoltz was a first ballot Hall of Famer. Me, personally, I don't think so. This guy did have the credentials again, 213 wins, a 3.33 earned run average, strikeouts to walks in his career, 3,084 to 1,010. So a 3-1 strikeout to walk ratio, pretty solid there. You've got that world championship, you've got that Cy Young award, and really most impressive to me, you've got the shift from starter to dominant closer, back to a pretty good starter. People forget he was actually a very decent all-star caliber starting pitcher for, I think, three seasons after he went back into the rotation in Atlanta. So you talk about being able to be used in any situation. John Smoltz was able to do that. He's able to win 213 games along the way, and he was part of that very talented trio in Atlanta with Glavine and Maddux. So you look back at that team and you look at his contributions, while they pale in comparison overall to what Glavine and Maddux did in some of the Braves' best seasons in the 1990s, I don't think there's any doubt that John Smoltz should be in the Hall of Fame. It is a little surprising that it was on the first ballot, but still, he got 85% of the vote. And with Glavine and Maddux going in the year before, it only made sense. Well, hey, this guy's not chopped liver. He was the main reason why the Braves were so competitive. And, going back to the World Series from this year, a lot of people reminisced about Game 7 between the Braves and the Twins from 1991 and how Game 7 between the Cubs and the Indians this year was very similar. Well, everybody remembers Jack Morris's performance, going the complete game 10-inning performance in that shutout. Well, John Smoltz was the starter for the Braves in Game 7. He went 8 shutout innings and just wore out there. Bobby Cox and Leo Mazzoni could go with anybody. So you go with John Smoltz, nothing wrong with that. They had plenty of other options. And, Smoltz gets the call in 91. You have to think he's a big reason why the Braves would have many, many quality years and a great pitching staff throughout the 1990s. So John Smoltz, a great pitcher, and in my opinion, the best color analyst in baseball today. A lot of people saw that during the World Series, but I was even remarking during some of the earlier playoff rounds, I'm like, wow, this guy. I mean, I've always known he's a smart guy. I've interviewed him before. He's got a lot of great information and details to share, but he just works so well in the booth, and he works extremely well with Joe Buck. And I don't know why people just hate Joe Buck. I like Joe Buck. I'm not going to say I'm a fanboy of Joe Buck, but I think Joe Buck does a fine job. And I think this is a unique TV booth here where Joe Buck and John Smoltz, they make one another better. And that's a very special chemistry in the broadcast booth. When a color analyst can make a play-by-play announcer better and vice versa, that's definitely a good thing. And we were all treated to that during this past World Series. And again, several of the preceding playoff games this past season. So Smoltz has made a great leap forward here, not just riding on the laurels of a Hall of Fame career, but being an outstanding analyst and broadcaster, and I think he's going to have a very good career for many, many years to come in that position. So there you go, John Smoltz, a random poll from the 1990 Fleer set, one of my personal favorites for a number of reasons. And I wonder if it's a favorite of yours too, or is it a boring, overproduced set? I know some people, they just don't like that set because it's from 1990. There's way, way, way too much of it out there. Yeah, that's okay. I'm totally fine with that. But let us know what you think at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, as we'll be looking at your commentary throughout the weekend. And we will, of course, bring in some of the comments and questions in our next podcast, which will be coming your way Tuesday. So we go from the classic throwback Americana baseball terrific feeling 1990 Fleer set to the Jackson Pollock, oops, I think I vomited on this orange sheet, 1990 Donruss set. Ugh. Yeah, it's a little bit of a letdown. Donruss took a step backwards in 1990. While other sets were looking all 1990, Donruss, I'm not really sure what it was looking like, but it wasn't looking good. We'll take a look at that set and our random pull of that next. That's coming up on Tuesday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Enjoy the weekend. Don't eat too much leftover turkey. And thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic.